Bottle dancing unicorns with glitter. Welcome to the Brew News Podcast, all the news that's fit to be brewed. I'm Andrew Jennings.
And I'm Travis Matherly.
And this week, we're talking about that Wicked Weed, Travis, that monster of the hot, the bind.
It's like we're going back to Wicked Weed.
We're not going back to Wicked Weed. We're talking about the Wicked Weed. We are talking about the one, the only, the creature that gives beer its life force. It is the one thing that keeps American brewing becoming trash like German brewing. I say that now, and I don't actually mean it. We're talking about hops.
And I'm just now realizing I opened the wrong notes because I was about to read brew etiquette.
well, Travis, like,
Andrew is completely off script at this point. I don't know where we're going.
he's a loose cannon. He got loose. I shouldn't have given him so much pipe works. All right. So before we get into this, I do want to talk about sort of like generally when we think of beer and beer cultures. And I know American beer culture, we're like, oh, it's just trash. It's Bud Light. It's not craft beer culture. It's its own thing. But when we think of beer cultures within different countries, we tend to think of terms of beer types. Like when you think of Germany, what do you think, Travis?
According to the notes, I'm thinking of dominated by malt forward lagers.
You can think about whatever you want. But
I'm thinking of Germany, you know, like Rheinhausgut comes to mind, like lagers, pilsners, Oktoberfest, you know, maybe like Box. Dunkel lagers.
Very smooth, drinkable beers. Malt forward.
Yeah, it is malt forward. It's not the hops that you get in German beer are floral and a little bit of fruity, not like
they're
citrus.
I was going to say, there's an accent. They're not there as the centerpiece.
Yeah.
Yeah. Belgian. What do you think? When I say Belgian, what do you think of?
Farmhouse, Trappist beer, Saisons,
so
funky.
Yeah, yeast is the big purveyor there. Mm-hmm. When I say British beers, what do you think of?
ESB. Porter, browns, bitters.
So balanced ish, say maybe?
Very mild beers.
Okay.
British beer is very mild to me. It's a lot more. British beer is like very more plain Jane, but if it's done very well, it can be very delicious.
All right. And when you say, when I say American beers, what do you think?
IPA.
I mean, yeah.
Hops.
You didn't have to say IPA, but you could have. Like, generally, American beer is British beer, but on steroids. It's like,
yeah,
it's like, okay, yeah, yeah, we took your
take that shit and crank it up to 11.
We took your style and we saw that you had this thing and we said, but what if
we saw this British IPA and said, we raise you all these hops in it.
I see your Ken Goldings. I raise you Cascade.
I said, oh my.
Oh no. The Americans, they've gotten too much power. Their hops are too strong.
They say.
But yeah, so each of these cultures, actually, when you think about it, except for the Brits, the culture of the beer brewing is defined by a specific ingredient within that. So in Germany, it's defined by the malt characteristic. In Belgium, it's defined by the yeast characteristic. In America, it's defined by the frickin' hop characteristic.
Yeah, because basically I would venture to say that most American IPAs use just about probably the same basic malt bill.
They are within like a standard deviation of each other. Like,
yeah.
They're almost all going to be there for the sugar because
it is crystal, two row.
Yeah, something like that. Two row for certain. And then after that, who knows? But the whole point is it's about the hop. It's about the hop experience. So, yeah, that's it. So before we get into
Thanks for joining us. We're done with hops.
Well, before we get into the history of hops, what they are and all that jazz, let's talk about, I made us a wet hop IPA, a wet hopped blonde.
A wheat hopped.
A wheat hopped. You got me out here drinking the beers and all that jazz. But I made a wet hop blonde ale. So I did grow some hops this year.
You did.
I was
one bucket one took
bind,
off.
One bind. One
the
bind.
Other ones failed
not,
to
not so much.
failed to come to fruition.
So I got about 4 to 5 ounces off of this thing and I made a blonde ale with them.
And that was what, Cascade?
It was all Cascade.
Right? Yep. I was going to say, because you had one I'd never heard of before, right?
I had Cascade, Red Vine, didn't take off. Crystal didn't take off. Chinook didn't take off. And I can't remember the third one.
I was going to say, Red Vine was one I think I'd never heard of.
Yeah, it was Canadian Red Vine. And I can't remember the fifth one I had that didn't take off either. And those actually just flooded.
Was it Enigma?
No, it was a more normal hop. But needless to say, I know what happened and why they didn't take off.
The pots flooded?
Yeah, they got flooded, and they never drained properly. The drainage was awful, so I'm going to have to redo those pots.
Boost those pots up, right?
I'm going to have to put more sand in them.
I was going to say, can you just drill a hole, like a few holes in
there's
the bottom?
There's four holes in the bottom already.
Oh, geez, Louise.
Yeah. They did not drain
drill
within
holes
day.
In the sides.
Yeah. I was debating about that or just changing out the substrate mix. So, but yeah.
Poor little hops.
So we're doing an American blonde ale that's made with wet hops.
Mm-hmm. So Andrew's beer is a little reddish orange in color.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little hazy.
So this is my...
Andrew's beers are unpasteurized, unfiltered.
Unfiltered, baby.
All natural.
I do do... This one is... I said it's a blonde ale, but it's sort of not. It was 7 pounds of ultralight LME or liquid malt extract. I decided to make this one easy for myself. I did 1/2 pound of honey, 1/2 pound of...
I can taste the honey.
Biscuit malt and 1/2 pound of Great Western Crystal 15L. Those just for steeping purposes. And then 7 pounds of ultralight LME. As far as hops are concerned, we do have 1/2 ounce of Magnum, 2 ounces of Tetanang, and then 4 ounces of the wet hop Cascade. Fresh. I literally harvested it while I was steeping the grains.
Pick. Rinse.
What?
Do you rinse them or you just throw them in?
I just tossed them in.
Oh, okay. There you go. So we got a little bit of dirt in there too and whatever happened to be floating around in
the backyard.
They
wanted to boil for 10 minutes, so they were fine. but yeah, and then I did use USO5. This had weirdness because for some reason the original gravity was a lot higher than it had need to be. I don't know why. The LME should not have put that much sugar in there, but it was an original gravity of 10.72.
Was it the honey?
No, it was honey malt, not honey.
Oh, yeah, okay. So I thought you just said honey.
No, honey malt, sorry.
Oh.
It was 10.72, which gives us an alcohol of...
Mm.
Can you guess?
5.
7.8.
Good Lord. That's an IPA, not a blonde ale, buddy.
I know. I didn't mean to.
It's a wet hopped IPA. That's what Andrew's trying to nose in on Celebration.
Yeah. So,
which, by the way, is in cans for the first time this year.
I saw that, yeah.
Yes.
It's going to be good.
It's going to be so good.
But all in all, I do like this beer. It is a blonde ale. It is a pale ale with a little bit of hops. It's really more of a pale ale, less of a blonde ale at the end of the day.
It is a touch sweet. It is, I will say it is like biscuity.
Mm-hmm.
Almost because of the sweetness, it almost makes me think been like, you know, like light brown sugar a little bit, mm-hmm. like graham crackery.
Can see that.
Almost just a tiny bit. But it does have that like nice little like thin wafer cookie,
mm-hmm.
like a crispy cookie crunch, you know, kind of like flavor to it.
Yeah. I enjoy it. It's a nice little, it's got a little bit of aspirin on the back end, I get.
Mm-hmm. There is just a teeny bit of that bitterness yeah. there lingering in the back, which kind of helps, I think, to clean up that
yeah.
little bit of sweetness.
And this was a situation where when I prepped the recipe, I got 7 pounds of malt because of extract, because in theory, 7 pounds of malt should be about 1040, mm-hmm. not 1070. Don't know what the hell happened.
You can't have your oil weights off.
I don't know. I don't know what happened here. But yeah, it should have been about 1040, not 1070. And so the fact that it had an extra pop, so it should be more smooth and it stressed the yeast out a little bit. So it shouldn't have that aspirin quality.
And they're like, there is too much sugar in here.
Honestly, yes. There's not enough yeast for the sugars amount.
Like, we just came here to have a good time and we're feeling so attacked by the sugar right now. I am stressing the F out.
Well, it's a situation where they showed up. It's like, okay, before you guys can leave, you have to drink the entire keg. And like, there's 6 of us and that's a full keg. Why would you do this to us?
Do it, freshman.
Pretty much, yes. This was the hazing of yeast that I did not intend.
And it's Bush Light. Oh, God.
Oh, no. But yeah.
We stole the keg from our neighbor's porch. And then we just had it filled. These sugars are real assholes in my story. They're like the ultimate frat guys.
Oh, they absolutely were. They absolutely were. Okay, so that brings us to hops.
Andrew, what are hops? Is hops?
Can one truly define hops? No,
yes, we can.
I was going to say, you are the botanist in our group.
What?
What?
Me?
Yeah, you.
I did take a year worth of horticulture at State.
It's more than I did.
Mm.
If it was an animal, I'd be down.
I did take horticulture, so I did do some family naming.
See?
So for brewing purposes, hops are cones that form on female hop binds. And that's binds with a B, not vines with a V.
Yep. Unlike most plants that are hermaphroditic, each hop bind is either male or female.
Oh.
But don't worry, come harvest time, you'll know which one you have.
Because the male won't have anything on it, and the female will have all the hops on it.
The male will have some delightful flowers.
Ah, pretty flowers.
And that's it.
Yes.
No cones.
The female hop vines will have all the hop cones that you want for your harvesting.
Yeah, the only thing you actually need as far as harvest is concerned. They are perennial, and they are bine. So perennial obviously meaning that they'll come back every year.
Mm-hmm.
And a bine is unlike a vine because a bine actually uses the, in this case, the hop actually has like a shark skin situation on the outside. So it uses that to grip stuff as opposed to...
It's got little tendrils that...
It's not tendrils. That's a vine. So a vine sends out little tendrils that hold it and pull it up.
Yep.
So like think your ivies and things like that. But this actually has like a rough...
So it's literally just like the... surface friction of the vine itself holding it to whatever it is.
Right. Now, it's got sort of like a Velcro quality, depending on what it's grabbing to, because it literally does have little hooks on it,
mm-hmm.
but it's not like sending out them. It's just shark skin effectively on the xylem or the phylum.
Phylum.
Sure.
I think.
I don't know. But whichever one's on the outside, it...
The mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.
God damn it. But yeah, on the outside of the stem, it's very like shark skinny, and that grips stuff and that pulls it all the way up.
Mm-hmm. So being perennial, like Andrew said, there's no need to replant vines because they come back every year on their own. So that makes it very forgiving to those of us who don't have the green thumb. In Andrew's case, though, they do have to come up the first time to begin with.
If they don't come up the first time, you're done.
You just need to restart. Start from scratch. So hops come in hundreds of varieties, and new varieties are being bred specifically in the Pacific Northwest. We also see this in like New Zealand and other places. Like there's always some hop production facility that's like hops are given a number. To begin with, it's like...
Uh-huh. They have an experimental number.
Yeah, it's like experimental hop number like 12578A mm-hmm. or whatever. And then once that becomes a proprietary hop of a company, they give it a name like...
Citra,
Centennial,
Amarillo.
Columbus. And then people are constantly crossbreeding hops with each other to form new... So it's like any kind of other horticulture like plant breeding thing where like you're just like crossbreeding and cross-pollinating these hops to come up with new varietals to get the qualities that you want in them.
Yep. And while selective breeding?
Yes, selective breeding.
In this case, it is forced breeding functionally, but no one.
They don't know. They don't have feelings.
That's true. Now, while commercial hop varieties tend to have very specific light requirements, don't worry. You can live anywhere and find wild hops. We actually have a bunch of wild hop vines in the South.
We have one in Andrew's backyard.
Well, no, that's cultivated. Yeah, but there are wild hop vines all over most places, specifically in the Northern Hemisphere, but they're just not grown for their commercial purposes, whether their cones are too small or they don't grow fast enough, you name it, for whatever reason, but there are hop vines.
And some places are better than others.
Well, they are, but the commercial hops we have very specific light requirements, which we'll talk about in a minute. Whereas the wild ones don't necessarily have those, but they also don't produce big, bountiful cones.
I guess like if you've ever seen a wild strawberry versus a cultivated strawberry, like wild strawberries are like itty bitty little strawberries. Itty bitty.
Yeah, it's very different.
Or like a wild onion is a very small onion.
Yeah. Or a wild garlic, things like that.
Yes.
Yeah, there's reasons why we've cultivated certain things and we grow them in certain places. So what do they do?
Well, Andrew... Hop varieties have various oils and chemicals that can impart different aromas and flavors and have a bittering quality when boiled. Not when simmered.
Well, yes and no. It's really about isomerization. If you don't do isomerization, then it's not going to give you that bittering quality.
Yes, of course.
Yes. So that isomerization converts the oils to the chemical that humans perceive as bitterness. And we don't need a whole hop cone to do that, actually. But instead,
you just need the powders.
Honestly, yeah. What we really need is that lupulin powder.
That sweet, sweet lupulin.
Yeah.
There you go with that word again.
Lupulin. You keep saying this word.
You keep saying lupulin. I don't think you know what it is. Lupulin.
Lupulin. Now, lupulin contains the homulones or alpha acids as well as beta acids. And that's where all the flavoring and bittering power comes from.
Yes. And this also acts as a preservative for the hops. And for beer. Well, yeah,
that's why we use it, is because honestly, it's a preservative for beer.
Yeah. So remember back, I think we've talked about it maybe in when we did the history of IPA, Andrew and Laura did that, I think.
I think it's history of beer, actually.
History of beer.
That was like 3 years
ago. So, lagers and things like that, when, continental Europe was colonizing and imperializing the rest of the world.
No, this is pre that.
No, pre that. Okay.
Because the
East India Trading Company?
No, it was the monks. The monks found it out in the...
Those crafty monks.
Well, remember, hops is part of Reinhardsgebot.
Yes.
So that was 1516.
Yeah. Well, it also, I mean, like, more specifically, I was thinking of the style of IPA where, like, they hopped beers specifically to make the trip from England to India around the Horn of Africa and that kind of stuff.
That particular, you're not talking about, like, adding hops to beer
It kept beer fresh and drinkable and preserved it so it can make the trip because things like porters and stouts would spoil in the heat due to lack of refrigeration. So, adding all those hops kept stuff, and that's where India Pale Ale comes from, as we've talked about before, because a hops make something shelf stable.
Yeah. No, I thought you were talking about like the monks found out that hops would keep their beer, would essentially allow them to become more than just a hometown brewery.
And unfortunately, due to their vow of silence, they didn't share that with anybody.
Except for other monks.
In written form only.
Of course.
They telecommunicated with other
it's
monks.
It's actually in the, I guess it's James 3. I'm not sure if that's
one monk held up a hop bind and looked at the other monk and just nodded, and the other one nodded in agreement. Was like,
We got this.
Yes, I see what you're saying here.
Yep. So let's talk about how they're grown. Actually, while they're doing that, I'm gonna grab something.
Yep. So hops are commercially, most hops are grown in the Pacific Northwest of the U.S., Germany, China. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I did not know that.
The number three location for hops.
But yes, the Pacific Northwest, Germany, China, Australia, and New Zealand, which is to be expected considering we see a lot of those are always what we refer to as Southern Hemisphere hops.
Yep. Now, hops are a spring fall grower, so you plant them in the spring, or you you expect emergence in the spring because you don't necessarily have to plant them every year, and you harvest in the fall. Hops are photosensitive, so that's why where Travis is talking about, those locations are important because they actually use the day-night cycle to determine when they're going to start coning. So it's very...
Like, should I cone?
Too much light?
Too much light. Nope.
Yep. So hops are
I can't just have my cones out here in the light like this. Got to cone out in the dark.
Cone out in the dark like a respectable adult.
Mm-hmm. I'm not dressed to receive.
No. Hops are best grown between 35 and 55 degrees latitude. That's north and south. So that's why the map is on the sheet. So you can see where like that 40 degree mark is where a lot of hops are grown, both the north and the northern and southern portion.
Yeah, so that's cutting through the Pacific Northwest for us and like what, Massachusetts probably?
Yeah, I'm actually shocked that there's not a lot of hop growing in New England area.
And that actually runs through like Spain, Italy.
Yeah, so like Germany is a little north of that, but it's less than 60 degrees.
Yeah, so. And then going south, you see a lot of that down to 40.
Auckland is on 40.
Yeah, New Zealand and Australia would be right in there. But you could also do a lot of hop growing in like South America and Southern Africa. Or like just Africa and South America in general.
Argentina is one of the top, I think, 10 hop producers in the world. South Africa, not so much. You can notice Africa is almost completely outside that band. Like they're completely collapsed within not that band.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah, they're just too central to the equator. And it's because you need like 15 hours. Like the hops really want 15 hours of sunlight. And you don't get that outside of that. Like I think we're like 33 degrees north, so we're like just pushing that boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And so like I can grow hops, but I can't grow a lot commercially.
Yeah. So most commercial farms are generally going to be in the 40 plus degree range, as Andrew said. And as we only need the female plants, hops are not grown from seeds, but rather from rhizomes. Oh, Andrew, what's a rhizome?
A rhizome is functionally is just a chunk of hop rootstock. You would just take a chunk off of a mature plant and plant it, and now you have a new rhizome. It's going to want to grow again. Rhizomes, for those of you that are into...
botany?
I say fungi. Oh. That's where rhizomes generally come from, is the way that mushrooms propagate is through rhizomes, not through seeds.
There you go.
Yep.
So...
Now you learned something.
Yes.
I'm going to learn you something good today.
So hops, as we talked about, are a climbing vine with their shark skin quality and as such need 20 plus feet of vertical structure to grow.
So my hop vines
have about 5 feet of vertical structure.
No.
And then they go off horizontally.
They do go. But
they think they're going vertically. They don't know the difference.
They don't know the difference. But those things, I think when I cut it down, I probably, if I had as much vertical space as they were wanting to grow, I probably could have gotten 30 feet out of them.
Yeah. And if you've ever seen a hop farm, like pictures of hop farms, it's like very like poles out in the middle of the fields, mm-hmm. with Shireen's. Almost kind of like a vineyard in a way, but
bigger. It's like,
it's like a vineyard on steroids.
Ton of telephone poles, mm-hmm. and you're running usually metal lines between the telephone poles, and then you're going to drop something that the hop can climb up.
Yeah.
And usually what that material is like a coconut fiber, coconut husk, because they need something rough mm-hmm. because their skin won't grab nylon rope, for example. I learned that this year because they weren't supposed to grow on the nylon rope, but they outgrew all the coconut fiber.
There you go.
So, and generally you're going to have these, have them have dropped those lines at each plant where each plant is. And then you may have to spend some time training them to climb the rope. But once they start climbing, in the Northern Hemisphere, they actually grow in a clockwise rotation because they follow the sun around.
And they go in the south and they go in a counterclockwise because the toilets flush backwards?
I'm assuming it's because of the toilets. That's the most logical explanation. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with the sun.
No. Hop farms also typically use, like we talked about, these large trellises. So that's the technical term for it if you wanted to be technical, as a trellis.
Yep.
So once the hop plants start climbing, it's fairly hands-off, but the occasional bit of pruning or training, as Andrew said, is needed.
Yep. Hop plants in general are very thirsty bitches, but they can become waterlogged. They are a very water-intensive plant because they will grow up to a foot a day.
And as Andrew said, though, drainage is key, as he found out this
year. Yep. If you don't drain them properly, they ain't going to do it. But
even though they love water, they don't want to be drowned in it.
Yeah, they don't want to be drowned. But they will. I even watched mine. I could come out in the morning and actually see them grow from the day before. Mine didn't grow a foot a day, but they can grow up to a foot a day. They grow like weeds when they want to.
Yes. So hops are very heavy users of nitrogen and are a favorite, I'm assuming, snack or food source.
Yes.
Of Japanese beetles and several fungi. So for this reason, proper fertilizers and pesticides are key, so you're not getting any organic hops.
In general, you're not. Even my little hop vine, in the middle of an area that doesn't have a ton of Japanese beetles, if I hadn't treated it with insecticides, I would have lost the whole vine, because the Japanese beetles just got onto it and just started making everything Swiss cheese.
That's not what you want.
Yeah, it's not ideal. Less than ideal. So in general, though, weeds are not an issue, so you don't have to worry about herbicides so much, just because once the hop vines get to be about 2 feet tall, they're taller than anything that's going to choke them out from light purposes.
They're
going
to choke it out.
Effectively,
you don't
yeah.
choke me. I choke you.
Yeah. No.
No.
I am a hop vine. You misunderstand me, dandelion. I have power here, not you.
Yes. So for harvest commercially, you tend to take the entire vine, generally from the 2 to 4 foot mark and up, and separate the cones from the vine using a machine, or in Andrew's case, his hands.
I actually hand trimmed all of my hops.
Oh, look at you.
I was artisanal.
I twirled
my mustache. I had my suspenders on.
And your wide-brimmed hat.
Of course.
And your big round sunglasses.
I did have some zinc oxide on my nose.
Pruning unironically.
I did it early in the morning, so the sun wasn't up. And then as far as overwintering is concerned, because they are perennials, you can literally just cut the vine back to the ground and fresh vines will grow next year.
They just lay in wait.
Yep. Now, it does take some time to establish a true vine, usually about 3 years. Year one, you're focused on root and plant health. So the goal is to get a really big, good quality rootstock and you're just trying to get growth of any kind, shape, or form. The fact that I got anything to harvest in year one was just gravy. It wasn't the purpose for year one. Year two, this is when the number of hops produced is going to be indicative of the quantity of hops you'll have moving forward, not necessarily the quality. And by year three, that's what your hop plant is going to produce pretty much year in and year out, the quantity and the quality of that hop.
If you don't like it, rip it out.
You're on your
start
own.
Start over.
Yep.
Now, that's about 4 years quicker than it takes to establish a vineyard.
I know you can get decent vines in 3 years.
Yeah. I think back in college, I think we were told like from planting to like actual wine production grapes takes about like 7 years.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting good wine then.
Yeah.
I'm doing Muscadine, like, baby.
To do like good high quality grapes is like 7 years from planting it in the ground to like having vines that can produce like a good quantity of grapes for wine.
I was gonna say, and also beyond that too, it's not with wine, it's not just the like hops, you're gonna toss them in a beer and immediately drink it. But mm-hmm. with wine, you have to age that thing out.
And it's all about the vintage.
Of course.
And speaking of wine and vintages and such, let's take this time to move on to terroir.
I was going
to
say, pick up your glass and shake it around a little bit and talk about the terroir.
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 Now, so terroir, for those of you who are unaffiliated with French, is the French word for earth.
All right, moving on.
Yes, it's commonly heard as part of winemaking. So certain grapes are grown in certain places, and they taste very differently based upon the land that they are grown. So I've had wine from, you know, wine from certain parts of France will even be different. You have Alsace versus Rhone versus they even have left and right bank, like East and West Bank Rhone, Chablis, that kind of stuff. Like you have,
German wine. Yeah. My personal favorite, because France is a whole different ballywhack, and I don't want to get into that because I'm not a sommelier. But my favorite is to think about Sauvignon Blanc. Like that's a wine to me. If I get a Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand, I generally enjoy it. If I get a Sauvignon Blanc from the Pacific Northwest, I tend to enjoy it, but it's not always a guarantee. If I get a Sauvignon Blanc from anywhere else, I'm probably not going to like it. And it's because of the terroir. It's the same grape grown in different places. But it, because of the minerality of the soil, what have you, generally like a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is very minerally, very crisp. Some are very grapefruity, very...
Yeah, Sauvignon Blanc has always been described to me as like, do you like grapefruit?
Yeah. And
because that's what Sauvignon Blanc is.
And some of them really much are, but you get like a Willamette Valley or New Zealand, very different than a French Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah, and it's also taking like the same wine and like saying like, okay, Napa Valley versus France versus the Pacific Northwest versus South America. Like Argentinian wine, which I love.
Or South African wine.
I love South American and Spanish wine.
Oh, excellent.
The most. I think Spanish wine pairs the most well with food.
Spanish and Portuguese, for those of you that like wine, Spanish and Portuguese wine punches above its dollar class. Whatever you're paying.
Oh, yeah. Whatever you can get that stuff for cheap. Yeah, and it's very good, especially with food. Malbecs. I love a good Malbec.
Add $10, $20 to a Spanish wine, and that's the equivalent French
value. Whatever you paid, add 20%.
Yeah. That's pretty much it. Like French, like Spanish wine, it punches above its weight class in terms of, you know, its dollar.
Yes. So moving on, though. Terroir is the complete natural environment in which a particular wine is produced, including factors such as soil, topography, and climate. So that's the characteristic taste and flavor imparted to a wine by the environment in which it is produced. So I'm not going to pronounce all the French that Andrew put in there at the bottom.
Oh, I just copied it from the dictionary. But why do we care about terroir? Because hops care about terroir.
Yes, they do.
Ever so slightly, but they do.
This isn't the right terroir.
Oh, no.
I must not grow.
Well, no, they just taste different. Yes. So taking a hop plant from one location to another and growing them the exact same way will actually result in two hops that impart flavor and aroma differently.
Yes.
They may actually, for example, Tettnang. There's two versions of Tettnang. There's Tettnang, which is the German.
And Tettnanger.
And Tettnanger, which is grown anywhere else. They have different alpha acids. They have slightly different flavor characteristics.
That's why sparkling wine, not made in the Champagne region of France, cannot be called champagne.
Well, no, that's a marketing issue.
It's kind of almost.
It's a marketing issue. It's a marketing issue. And we'll talk about marketing issues with hops in a little bit, too. But because of this, certain regions become either famous for or necessary for a certain hop profile.
So let's talk about how hops are used. So once a hop is harvested, they are generally dried and either sold as whole cone or compressed down into pellets and then sold as pellets. So a lot of what home brewers use are pelletized hops.
And most commercial brewers, too.
Yeah.
For that matter.
Yeah. Getting a whole cone hop is only like more a seasonal thing. Like Andrew did this wet hop blonde ale.
Whole cones are not necessarily...
wet hopping is more
seasonal. Wet hopping is seasonal. But whole cone, the biggest advantage, I don't know if there is an advantage to that, but the problem is like you use a 5-to-1 ratio or like to go from pellet to whole cone. So like if you're going to be economical, whole cones are cheaper per ounce, but it takes five times as much. So you might as well just buy pellets and then you have less plant matter and it's a lot easier brewing process.
Yeah. So hops are then added to the boil for their delicious oils. Any boil longer than 20 minutes will remove the flavor and aroma compounds. So a bittering addition is added usually at the start of a boil.
Yep. So hops give aroma, bittering, and flavor. Aroma and flavor, the same thing. But if you more than 20 minutes, all that good, those good funky flavors are going to go away. They're going to boil out. So during the last 20 minutes or so of the boil, flavor additions are added with aroma additions the last 5 minutes or so. And I think we talked about this in another episode, but like our traditional IPA hop schedule. So IPA, we're going to use that as a sort of our basis for this because IPA is a hop beer. Like when we say IPA, the way I define IPA is it's a beer where the hop is the predominant character, flavor. Like that's what you want. You're trying to highlight the hop. Mm-hmm. As opposed to like a Mexican stout where you're trying to showcase these the chocolate and the the spices and things like that. You're trying to showcase the hops for an IPA.
Yeah.
Traditionally, IPAs had a schedule of bittering addition at 60 minute, flavor addition at 20 minute, another flavor addition maybe at 10 minute, an aroma addition at 5, and aroma addition again at 1 minute or flame out.
Yeah. So your hops will continue to give off oils for flavor and bittering as long as the wort is above 180 degrees Fahrenheit. So you don't immediately chill your wort. You can add additional bitterness or flavoring depending on how the additions work out.
Right. So this is why chilling your wort is so key or crucial or...
In because way, it preserves what you've got?
Well, no, because otherwise you wind up with a beer that's more bitter than you intended. Gotcha. And you lose some of that flavor and the aroma compounds as well. Or the way I make my IPAs, that's sort of what you want.
Yeah.
You want that to be smoother. And then another common practice is to add dry hop or adding, and this is all the rage right now is dry hopping. So when you dry hop a beer, your dry hopping consists of adding additional hops to the fermenter for 3 to 5 days. If the beer is actively fermenting, this is actually called biotransformation. I have done it on accident once. And by on accident, I mean it fit my schedule, my hop schedule. So I just did it and it happened to be biotransforming. I don't really know the difference. I don't think it matters. Most people, though, are going to do their dry hopping after fermentation has completed.
Yeah. And so you see a lot of beers, if you see it like dry hop, double dry hopped beer.
Triple dry hopped.
Yeah, it just kind of gets ridiculous after double dry hopping.
Honestly, I triple dry hopped one time. I'm not doing it again because I didn't notice the difference between that and my single dry hop I do.
And there you go. Yep. Well, now that we've talked about that, let's talk about what forms of hops exist. As we've already alluded to, whole cone hops
these are
the way it comes off the bind.
But dried.
These are able to be used at any time. Normally, these are compressed down into like bricks, aren't they?
Shrink wrapped. If you go to like Sierra or New Belgium or someone and do like their hop tour, yeah, you'll see like a pallet sized brick of whole cone hop.
Yeah. Then they also have pellets, which we talked about, which are able to use at any time. And then wet hops / fresh hops like Andrew had here, which you can use at any time, but that's normally a seasonal thing.
Yeah. And when we say use anytime, we're talking about use anytime during the brewing process.
The harvesting. Oh, okay.
During the brewing process.
Okay. Gotcha.
Because you can only get wet hops during.
Once a year.
Cryo hops / lupulin powder. It's the same stuff. Cryo hops are just lupulin powder. Generally, you're only use this for dry hopping. The main reason is it's a concentrated version of the lupulin powder of what you want. Less vegetal mass. You're not going to lose as much to hop absorption if you use this in your dry hopping. It's just so expensive, it doesn't make sense to do it for your other additions.
Yes. Then you have distilled hop oils. This is a substitute for wet hops, generally used as a dry hop. Hop oils, I would think of maybe Sierra Nevada's like Hop Hunter or Hoptimum.
Yeah, something like that. Hop Hunter does use hop oils. I don't know about Hoptimum, though.
Hoptimum's like a triple IPA.
Well, you can...
But I think it has hop oil in it. Okay. And then you have hop extracts, which you can use at any time during the brew process.
And that's literally just a syringe of hop that you just shoot in. Pretty much, yeah. It's literally just a distillation of everything. And like they have Magnum versions of this, and Magnum's a bittering hop. So you're not using it for anything but bittering.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. So now we've all heard about different types of hops. We've probably heard about the noble hops. We've probably heard about the sea hops.
And the peasant hops.
And the peasant hops, yeah. And
the surf hops.
The surfs, yes. But the noble hops, let's talk about the noble hops real quick, because these are some of the most... I wouldn't say sought after, but like common hops that you'll ever hear of. And people get all their panties in a twist about noble hops.
Yes, they will.
So, Travis, what are the four basic noble hops?
That would be Mittelfrüh, or from Hallertau, which is commonly referred to as Hallertau Mittelfrüh.
Not Mittelfrüh from anywhere else.
No, just Hallertau Mittelfrüh. Spalter, hailing from south of Nuremberg. So if you see a non-Spalting Spalter, it's not Spalter.
You got to watch out for that.
Yep. Tettnanger, which is named from the region of Tettnang, located southeast of Stuttgart and southwest of Munich. And then Saaz/Zatek from Bohemia.
Now these are called noble hops for an ignoble purpose. A salesman named them.
They're all German.
Nope. Salesman named them.
Ah, there you go.
And also one of them is Czech.
You better check yourself, Andrew.
They're all German and Czech hops. I make no promises. And most commonly, they're found in German-style beers. So your Pilsners, your Schwarz beers, things like that.
So these are the hops that, as we alluded to earlier, are not over-the-top, like, piney, citrusy. These are more floral. These are more...
earthy. They can be...
earthy. They're more muted flavors. They're very, like, a... yeah. Supporting player when they're used. They're not like to be the over like main focus of the beer.
For the record, for like context, term alpha acids is a good example, a good way to compare hops. Alpha acids is a it's something you can actually determine. So the AA for most of these hops is going to be around 3 to 4, maybe 5 if you're pushing it. It's going to be a really bitter version of that hop. Most American hops like Cascade and Willamette, for example, are some of the mildest ones. They're going to start around 7.
Ah.
And then up from there, like Centennial, the Centennial I have at my house is 9.1. Chinook's like 11.2. Magnum's 12.
You say Enigma is like 16 or something.
Yeah, Enigma's like 16. Like they get really bitter when you get to the New World hops. So the Old World hops are going to be very light. So because they're light, you have light bitterness, which means you either need to use a lot of them or the hops are a supporting character. They're not going to be the star of your show.
Yeah. And now while... these four are the noble hops. You can have other versions of them as well when purchasing Tettnang, which is Andrew's preferred hop for Helles and O-Fests, Oktoberfests.
Yep.
You have to specifically buy German Tettnang. Any other Tettnang may be grown elsewhere and could impact the terroir and flavor. So that's like we said earlier, Champagne not being from Champagne region of France can't be called Champagne. It has to be called something else.
In this case, actually, it can be called Tettnang. You just have to be very careful. If it's called German Tettnang, it's from Germany. If it's just called Tettnang or Tettnanger, it's probably not from Germany.
Yep. So then additionally, you have Mittelfruhl is not always a noble hop, as only the Mittelfruhl grown in the Hallertau region north of Munich is considered the noble version of that hop.
Right. So you can have Mittelfruhl from Germany, but if it's not from Hallertau,
it's not
noble.
Hallertau Mittelfruhl.
Yeah. Now, there are two English, quote, noble hops, but they're English, so they're not really that noble. They're not considered part of the noble quartet. It's Fuggle and East Kent Goldings. These can often be substituted for the noble hops if you really want to, but, I mean, they're not part of that noble club. They're out here like, oh, we would really love to be part of your club. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be fun. Yeah, it'd be great.
Oh, yeah, it'd be fun, but you could sit outside.
Yeah, so...
we'll allow you to sit on the patio.
Oh, we'll think about it, yeah. It's been a bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this just a line? You need to get into
that. You need to get into the line. You need to jump behind Enigma. It'd be fine.
So, noble hops are, as we've said, in general, well-balanced with low bitterness and light flavors. They're excellent for making lagers or malt forward brews and can be substituted for each other. And then we have a break to smell Tettnang.
So I was trying to delete all this before you got in here. I meant to bring over versions of all these hops. Completely forgot.
Well, dadgummit.
Yep. I was like halfway here. I was like, oh, shite.
I forgot the hops.
All right. Well, let's move to the sea hops. So noble hops are all going to be European. They're going to be light. Sea hops are all American.
Yes.
These are our classic American hops. There's going to be the five C's. Travis, without reading the notes, can you give the five C's?
Cascade.
Check.
Centennial.
Check.
Chinook.
Check.
Columbus.
Check.
Centennial, Cascade, Columbus, Chinook. Oh. Citra. Sorry.
Bingo.
Sorry, I forgot Citra.
Yeah. So these are common West Coast IPA hops. Ironically, Citra, which is the newest of the group, also sort of falls into like it's hitting that new age bit too. It's like the hipster hop because Cascade and Centennial have sort of lost their luster, even though they're still used very commonly. There's two very good, if you ever want to find out what those hops taste like, there's two beers I would recommend you to try. And then Chinook and Columbus, they I love Chinook. I use more Chinook. I'm starting to use more and more Chinook now than I ever have.
Yeah.
And Columbus is honestly sort of a, I'd like to try that. I've never used the CTZ, but let's talk about these hops in general.
Yes. So Cascade, as far as flavor and aroma goes, mostly gives off grapefruit and citrus. The best commercial example of Cascade hopped beer is Sierra Nevada Pale Ale.
Yeah, it's a...
That's old school.
Old school. It's a... It's an all Cascade version, so any hop character you get is Cascade. Yeah. The Centennial is also a flavor aroma hop. This is a supercharged version of Cascade, even more grapefruit, even more citrus. And the best commercial example is Bell's Two Hearted, which is an all Centennial IPA.
Yes, and I feel like whenever we talk about these, like if you see like guys are trying to go for like that old style feel of IPA, they typically do use like Cascade, Centennial, and Columbus or something like that, like a combination like of those. Then we move on to Citra, which Andrew said is the newest one. That's a flavor and aroma hop. It's tropical fruit and strong citrus. It's one of the most popular hops for IPA brewers at the moment.
I didn't put any like a perfect example.
Because there's just a ton.
Because there's so many, you can find one in your local.
Well, I mean, like we've done before, like Heist has like...
Citraquential. Yeah.
I think there's another brewery in Charlotte that has like... Citra Ass Down and like
yeah isn't just, that Noda or someone no
it's not Noda it's like I can't remember
that. Yeah, I know who you're talking about though,
but there's just a lot of examples of like people love to do single hop Citra beers.
Infinite Citra. Yeah, Chinook is a dual purpose hop, so that means it's used, it can be used both for bittering, so it has a high AA content, as well as for flavoring, but you very rarely see it for anything but bittering. Generally, it's going to be piney and orangey flavors and aromas. However, it's more common, like I said, it's more commonly used for bittering than flavor. Personally, I'm using it more for flavor now because Magnum is a perfect bittering hop, and I like the flavor and aroma that you get out of Chinook. It's delicious.
Well, there you go. And I mean, Magnum is just kind of like a general bittering hop, right?
There's not much on Magnum. It's just good for bittering. It's got a high AA, so you can get that bittering, that clean bitteringness. It's perfect.
Yep. And then the last one is Columbus, which is a dual-purpose hop. It's more earthy with faint citrus. It's generally used for bittering, but it's also known as Tomahawk or Zeus. Collectively, this complex is called CTZ.
Yeah, so if you see Columbus, Tomahawk, Zeus, or CTZ, it's all the same hop. It's one hop.
Yeah.
Now, there are new hops. Hops are constantly...
Every day.
They're constantly being grown in various parts of the world, specifically U.S., New Zealand, and Australia. Hop growers are creating some of the most sought-after hop varieties.
Yep.
Generally, these hops are going to be used in IPAs or pale ales, but we're seeing new world hops being added to old world recipes.
Yeah, so people may be tweaking like an older recipe and replacing the more traditional hops of that recipe with some of these new school hops. Admittedly, not in the old world, but France is trying out some new varieties with their Belgian-influenced brews.
Yep. Some of the most popular hops right now, based on sales, this is actually from a 2018 sales report. Galaxy was the number one hop sold.
Mm-hmm. Everybody, that's hard to get your hands on.
It is impossible to get your hands on. I mean, when people ask me, like, what's it cost to a home brewer for ounces? Well, depending on the hop, it can cost me anywhere from $1 to $5 an ounce.
Yep.
Galaxy's $5 an ounce.
Yeah. Then you have Nelson Sauvin, which we see from New Zealand. That is become, we've had a lot of beers with Nelson Sauvin in it, and it gives a lot of like white wine.
It's very Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah, it gives a lot of white wine qualities to the beer. I actually really like that hop.
It's like a more white winey version of Enigma. I feel Enigma gives some of that, but not as much.
Yeah, then you have Mosaic, which can go one of two ways. It can go citrusy and tropical fruity, fruit or it can go cheesy BO, depending on what you get, like chivy.
Amarillo
by morning.
It's absolutely one of my favorite hops. I need to do an IPA with Amarillo and Chinook since I have both. I might do that soon because that sounds delightful. And then finally, you have Simcoe, which is the parent plant to Mosaic. Mosaic was birthed off of Simcoe.
Ah.
So you tend to get a lot of the same flavor profiles. Turns out you don't need as much Mosaic relative to the amount of Simcoe you might need.
It's like a more concentrated version?
More or less. I'm not saying that I made that mistake once, but I did.
Ooh.
Things happen.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of these newer hops all have big aromas and flavors with very high alpha acid contents, as Andrew said. In order to use them properly, it is a good idea to use them solely for late additions, as he also alluded to. They can be rather expensive, and they also easily add a ton of bitterness. So you get a lot of bang for your fuck on that one. It's more costly, but it takes less to do what you need to do than more traditional hops.
I know,
which in conjunction, I guess, like leads you to have less vegetal matter again in that form.
I think at one point, Galaxy could only meet, like in terms of like demand on these hops, Galaxy, for example, was a hop where you could only get in the US 86% of the demand. Like it just wasn't being produced enough at all.
Yeah. What are you going to do? They can only make what they can make.
I mean,
and it's good for them to keep the supply like crunched like that because it just keeps demand high.
Well, yeah, I know. But like, because what will happen is they'll move off to something like Strata.
You give them just enough, Andrew, to keep them on the hook coming back.
No, I mean, I would just switch to Strata because I actually like Strata better than Galaxy, but that's personal.
Some of these guys just want that Galaxy.
I know they do. The Galaxy is delicious though when done properly. I'm not going to deny that. Well, Travis, any final thoughts on hops? I mean, we've established that it's crucial to American brewing, but beyond that, like,
it is a wicked and pernicious weed.
It will,
according to Henry the something,
the eighth.
Yes,
we'll go with that. But I mean,
now I'm just thinking of Boys in the South. Can't you see this is the last act of a desperate, desperate man? We don't care if it's the first act of Henry the Fifth. We're out of here.
But yeah, I like hops. I think they're fun. They do add a lot to specifically American brewing.
Specifically. I think it's interesting to see how hops grown in different regions, like we talked about with the terroir. Like New Zealand hops always kind of, like you can tell the difference in beers that use New Zealand hops versus American hops versus noble hops, obviously. Noble hops are like, you know, you only see those in traditional style, but like I feel like brewers nowadays only use noble hops when they're trying to make more traditional style beers, like true to form. But like you can get crazy with a lot of these. And then they make a lot of like, you know, I don't think we even touched on it, but like certain, what is it, Falconer's Flight is like a proprietary blend.
Good call. Zythos is the same. It's a
blend of hops.
And they change it every year.
Yeah. So it's like Falconer's Flight hop is actually a combination of like maybe five hops in different ratios.
Between 5 to 7 hops every year, and they change the ratio every year based on what they want.
Yeah, and so it's like, you know, you can buy a mishmash of hops, you can buy whatever you want. There's a hop for every purpose, but it's very interesting to see the areas that they're grown in and how like it is like grapes and any other thing, where like it's a lot of it is based just on the land and like where you're growing it. And what you're growing it on really truly affects the flavors and the qualities of that product.
Absolutely. Well, I'm a big fan of hops. I think they're going to do great moving forward.
I think this hop thing's really going to, this beer thing's really going to take off.
I trust in it. But I think it's going to be interesting because you're starting to see like hops being used for things like hop water and like non-alcoholic stuff.
A lot of hop water is coming out.
Yeah.
So that's expensive as shit though.
Not that bad.
Yeah.
I can make hop water for cheap.
There you go. Instead of a seltzer, make some hot water.
I mean, honestly, I'm not going to do seltzer again if I don't have to.
Please don't.
It's not that good. I've never made a great one. I made an okay couple, but... All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for joining us. You can follow us on Twitter at @brew_news or on Instagram at @brewnewspod. If you want to learn more about brewing beer, you definitely follow us there because you'll find me on stories talking about brewing beer.
Yes. You can follow us on Untappd. I am at @MatherNuts and Andrew is at @TubaSteve. You can shoot us an email at brewnewspod@gmail.com if you have any thoughts or suggestions on breweries or topics that you'd like us to discuss or cover. And as always, we thank you for your support and thank you for listening. We can't wait to catch you next time. Cheers.